This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. On today's show, the impact of the new I-71 MLK interchange. But first, a University of Cincinnati professor is helping NASA plan the next mission to Mars in search of ancient life. Dr. Andy Chaya is among a team of scientists determining where on Mars to land the most sophisticated rover to date. Part of the Mars 2020 mission is to collect rock samples for evidence the red planet once sustained microbial life. Here to discuss the mission to Mars, our UC Department of Geology Assistant Professor, Dr. Andy Chaya, UC graduate student Andrew Gangadine, and Cincinnati Observatory Outreach Astronomer Dean Regas. Dean's also the author of the book Facts from Space and co-host of the PBS series Stargazers. You can join us 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Dean, Andy, and Andrew, thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Andy, how did you get involved in this?
Well, so I'm involved as part of the Return Sample Science Board for the Mars 2020 mission. And that board was selected by they sent out a call for proposals to join the board. You know, you had to explain your expertise and interest and why you might be able to help help decide what would be the best types of samples to, you know, and the best places to go on Mars to find those samples that for to collect samples that we might want to bring back in the future for to help answer fundamental questions about the history of Mars, both the history of life and the history of the planet itself. So I have some expertise in the early life, studying early life on Earth, and thought, well, I'm interested in doing this. I've always been interested in space and Mars. I think like most kids are, and that hasn't changed for me over time. I thought, yeah, I'd like to get involved with this, and so I submitted an application, and I was selected.
Were you surprised?
I was actually, yeah, because I found out there was, I'm trying to remember, 60 or 100 or so people who applied for this, and there's about a dozen of us on this board. So I was quite pleased to be and honored to be selected to help guide this. I mean, we're an advisory board, but it's just still very honored. You know, very honored to be part of it.
Now, on this Mars 2020 mission, Andy, the rover is going to collect rock samples.
Yes.
What do you look for in a rock sample that shows evidence of life? What are you looking at specifically?
Well, there's a number of things you can look at. And the general term for those things are biosignatures, just a signature of life. And there's quite a number of things you can look for. You can look for morphological biosignatures, so things that have the shapes of life. So if you have a microscope—
Sort of like a fossil?
So a fossil, okay. Yes, a fossil would be say on Earth you find a bone. You know, that's a morphological biosignature. But if you're thinking more simple life like bacteria can leave fossils in rocks too. They can be preserved morphologically. You can see the actual remnants of a bacterium preserved in a rock. Of course, you need to cut the rock into a very thin slice and look at it through a microscope to find those. It's not something you can find just by picking up a rock and looking at it. But that's the type of thing you could look for. You could also look for what are called, on Earth we call them stromatolites, more broadly microbialites. So just meaning a rock that's formed through the processes of life, but biology, microbes used some processes that influence the formation of this rock. They basically think of a microbial mat, like a slimy mat, like on a lake shore, or a seashore, like in the mud. Well, you build up enough layers of that. If it gets solidified or what we call lithified or turned into a rock, that can be preserved in the rock record too. And you'll see these little, if you look at it in cross section, you'll see these little wavy layers in that rock, and that's typically indicative of life having had an influence in forming it. Maybe the bacteria that formed it aren't present anymore. They may have deteriorated and not been preserved, but their house basically has been preserved. So that's basically the two types of morphological evidence we might expect to find on Mars. We're not expecting to find you know, bones or large animals or plants, because it probably didn't get to that stage if there's a life there at all. It probably is in the microbial stage. But also you can look for chemical signatures. Sometimes organisms will concentrate certain elements in and around their bodies, you know, when they're alive, and that can get locked into the rock too. So you can look for certain concentrations of elements. You can look for isotopic signatures. So certain elements come in different types. There's carbon has three isotopes, and life uses different types of carbons in different ways. And so if you can find a signature based on the ratio of these isotopes in the rock. However, a lot of these types of signatures will require us to bring samples back from Mars to actually do the analyses, because you need instruments with very sensitive instruments to detect these chemical signatures, or you might need microscopes to actually see these and any bacterial fossils.
I'm amazed at what you can learn from a rock.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, well, you know,
I never realized it was that much.
Yeah, rocks are basically, you know, the history book of the Earth. I just read that somewhere, and I wish I could remember where I just read that, but somebody else said that. I don't want to take credit for it, but it's the history book of the Earth. So, you know, that's where we look back through the layers of rock to find out what happened deep in time. That's the only way we know anything that happened longer ago than we started writing things down.
And these rocks on Mars, I mean, these are things that formed underwater maybe, or is that another thing to be thinking of? Is that we think of all these places that were, you know, shallow lakes or shallow seas. Are we looking for sea creatures?
So that is a good point that, yes, we are looking for things that typically formed underwater, because water is an absolute requirement for life on Earth. We expect it to be a requirement or some sort of liquid medium is required for life as we know it. You need something for molecules to float around in, and they can't be frozen solid in solid ice. So we would expect water, and there's lots of evidence for bodies of water on ancient Mars, both lakes and possibly seas, I guess, depending on your definition of, you know, and where the cutoff is in size. And I don't know anything about the salinity of that they would have. But yeah, so I guess you could call them sea creatures, though. Again, we'd probably expect them to be like algae and single-celled things. You know, they could have formed big colonies that would have been visible, just like you see an algal bloom and lakes on Earth when you get nutrients put in. But individually, they're going to be microscopic cells.
How big are these samples going to be that the rover is collecting?
Well, the listeners can't see, but it's about the size of my pinky, which is sort of a standard size pinky, I suppose. Maybe, you know, I forget the exact dimensions. What would we say that is about 2 inches, 2.5 inches long, maybe, you know, a centimeter around. And that's the size of the coring bit. So this mission, the Mars 2020 mission, is going to have a drill on the arm that will be able to core into various types, you know, many types of rocks as we can find, and take a sample and store it in a hermetically sealed tube, and that's what this mission will do. It'll collect samples that we find interesting and put them in tubes. Unfortunately, you know, because the mission is taking place, you know, hundreds or hundreds of millions of miles away, depending on where, you know, where Mars and Earth are in their orbits, you know, this has to be done remotely, and we have to send everything with it that we are ever going to have for the mission. So there's a limited number of sample tubes. We have a limited number of opportunities to collect things. So we can't just bring back bags and bags of rocks like we might do on Earth if we were to travel somewhere to collect samples. So we have to be very selective. When I say we, I mean, I'm only involved with the mission so far at this point. I may or may not be involved with the mission when it's, when it's in the operation stages, but I'm hoping to be. But there will be a limited number of samples, so we have to be selective. The mission will have to be selective with the samples that are brought back.
And it could be quite some time before the samples get back, too.
Yeah, and then that's another thing, too, is that the mission to go collect the samples, pick them up off the surface and bring them back has not been funded yet. So that's not even a guaranteed to happen, but you know, once the mission goes and collects samples and they're on the surface, well, there's certainly more impetus to go get them. But that's up to a future mission, and that still has to be funded.
So,
to bring everything with you, microscopes, how about a grad student? Put a grad student on board, that might work.
I'm sure there's a number of grad students that would love to go.
Andrew, tell us about what your role in this whole thing.
Yeah, so I wanted to get involved with this kind of stuff, so I found Andy, and, he seems like a great person to do this with. What NASA's trying to do with all of this is they're trying to make the mission count. This is a multi-billion-dollar mission. They're not going to be able to send as many as they want to, so they want significant results. So they want to say, when we go here and we're looking for life, we want to have results that can say this probably was life or this probably wasn't life. So significant negative results matter. So what my role is in my research is I'm trying to look at these biosignatures that Andy was talking about, and I'm trying to see, can I classify something that points to more definitively when we get these samples back? Yes, this is probably life, was probably life, or no, this probably was not life.
So why signs of ancient life as opposed to existing life?
Well, it's one thing, it's possible that there are signs of ancient life sitting right at the surface or close to the surface. This drill is only going to be able to go in about the depth of my pinky. The drill bit's only, it's going to go from the surface and drill in a couple of inches, a few inches. There's a chance that there's evidence of past life at those depths. We don't think it's very likely that there's extant life, living things on Mars at that depth, just because the conditions on Mars, depending on where you go, but the conditions on Mars are extremely cold, extremely dry. The atmospheric pressure is extremely low. There's a lot of UV. There's no ozone layer, so the UV flux to the surface is high. The cosmic rays are bathing the surface. So it's very difficult for life to exist, at least life like we know it on Earth, at the surface of Mars. But it could exist at depth. But we can't get to that depth with this particular mission. That's one reason. The other reason is for planetary protection reasons. NASA is tasked with not contaminating Mars with Earth life and also not contaminating Earth with Mars life if it exists. And so there's, right now there's just still some, concern about being able to do that safely. And, it's a very, very slim chance of anything going wrong. But, it's not my purview. So I don't want to speak too much about it because that's, NASA and has more to say about that, I'm sure. And,
yeah, that's a good explanation.
But yeah.
That's a good explanation.
Yeah.
We will continue our conversation about the next mission to Mars. You can join us, 513-419-7100. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and here to discuss the next mission to Mars are UC Department of Geology Assistant Professor Dr. Andy Chaya, UC graduate student Andrew Gangadine, and Cincinnati Observatory Outreach Astronomer Dean Regas. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Andy, what's been the process? As I understand it, there were probably about 80 sites when the board first started looking at these. They've been whittling them down. Now they're down to three. What's the process for doing that like?
All right. So initially, anyone who had a site they were interested in visiting on Mars could propose a site. And there were, I guess it was about 80. I'd forgotten that number, but that sounds about right. 80 or so. And that went to, I wasn't involved with the process immediately. I got involved with the process a little bit further in. So I don't remember exactly what happened from 80 down to, say, 30. Because when the Return Sample Science Board was formed in 2015, that was around the time of the second landing site workshop. So there had been a first landing site workshop where everyone interested got together out in Pasadena and you know, talked about the sites, and then they kind of whittled them down a little bit.
And you're using like the data from the orbiters pretty much, right?
Yes.
Is that what kind of determines
the
candidates?
Yeah. So that's really all the data we have for most of Mars. We've only visited on the ground with rovers and other landers a few places, but we have significant coverage of the planet with very high-resolution cameras and spectrometers that can tell about the types of rocks and the minerals that exist there. And so that's what people are using to decide where's a good place to go. And so then at the second landing site workshop, 20 or 30, I forget the number of sites were presented. And as a community, we sort of came together and kind of ranked the merits of them and decided, okay, we're going to focus on these eight. And there were eight sites. And then just this past February, so about a year and a half after the second landing site workshop, there was a third landing site workshop. And those eight sites were presented again. There was a year and a half for interested parties to look more closely at the orbital data that we have and any other information that we have and try to, you know, present the best case possible. And then it was whittled down to three sites.
I wondered, what's you have a favorite out of the three? Or is there a one, can you say? Or is it a secret ballot?
Well, I mean, I can have my own opinion and say whatever I want. But the in terms of the ultimately it's up to the to NASA, the administration of NASA, to decide where we're going. And all of, you know, my job and the job, you know, with the landing site decision, and I'm also on something called the landing site working group, you know, we're there to provide advice and to say, okay, here's what we think, you know, why we think this is the best site to go to. We haven't finalized that yet. We have another year to go through and try to come up with answer as many questions as we can about all these sites so we have the best information to make a decision or the best information to provide to those who are making the decision. I don't know that I have a favorite site. The problem is there are pros and cons for all of them, and they're, you know, different pros and cons because each site, and they're called Jezero Crater, the Northeast Syrtis, and Columbia Hills. And Columbia Hills is within the Gusev crater, and that's where the Spirit rover went. Spirit was one of the Mars exploration rovers that landed in 2004. So that's a site that we've already been to. So that site we actually know the most about, at least in terms of the details on the ground, because we've been there and explored it with a rover. And that has its pros and cons. The pro is we know more about it, and we have some evidence from images and some chemical data from the rover that there are hydrothermal deposits. So deposits just like at Yellowstone National Park or other hot spring sites around the world where silica is precipitated out of seawater, or excuse me, out of water, not seawater, out of, you know, water percolating out of the ground. And so we... it's, you know, nothing is ever guaranteed in life. So that's the best interpretation we have, that's how that formed. But the problem is we know a lot about that site. So sending a rover there that has, you know, all of these instruments on it, it's limited in terms of the new things we can learn other than those potential biosignatures, which is the reason it's still on the table, because it's very interesting for what we call astrobiology. And actually, this is something that my student Andrew has been studying.
Right. So my work deals with, Andy was talking about the silica, something called silicification of these fossils that we can find. So we think about fossils on Earth. Most people think about dinosaurs. Most people don't realize that bacteria itself can become fossilized. So what I'm trying to look at is what happens as these bacteria become silicified and turned into fossils of their former selves. And there are a lot of people, Dean, you were asking, you know, do you have any opinions? These NASA scientists, they have a lot of opinions about
this. Oh, sure. Yeah.
These meetings can get pretty heated with people saying, you know, you know, we're only going there probably once to do this.
And how many scientists are we talking about?
Oh, I mean, it's a room full of people.
A couple hundred at least.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, you know, there are these people arguing that, you know, you have to understand their thinking is, if there's life on Mars, it's got to be here. And you've got that argument from all sides. So what I'm working on is something that would be more related to the Columbia Hills site, which has these silica deposits in there. There's a very strong argument that that would be a good idea to go there, a good place that would have strong evidence for life. But so do the other sites, and we've already been there. So there's a lot of different pros and cons to each one of these sites.
And one of the issues with Columbia Hills too. As I said, we already know a bunch about it. And so, yeah, how do we balance that in terms of, going there again? And because we're now dedicating future missions to that site too, should we go back, if we decide to, go back and collect the samples, we're now sending another mission to this same site again, because the mission... The mission that goes and collects samples again, if that happens, would also have some science instruments on it too, because you're already sending a little rover to go pick up samples. You might as well put an instrument on it to measure a few things. So now we're sending, two more missions to this site that we've already been to, as opposed to just one more. So that's one concern.
Was that the site, when I was remembering when the rovers first got there and they're rolling across the surface, that when they would roll across the soil, the tracks that they leave behind seemed to not be quite mud, but at least was that more spirit than opportunity to kind of experience that? Is that why they're picking it, or is it kind of both?
I don't think it wasn't mud in the sense of it being wet, but there was very soft sediment.
Exactly.
And at this site, in fact, that was something else I wanted to mention too about Columbia Hills, was that we didn't know that these silica deposits existed until we landed there. So it's possible that similar deposits exist at these other two landing sites too, Jezero Crater and Northeast Syrtis, but we just haven't seen it yet because we didn't find it until we got there. In fact, the Spirit rover drove through, one of its wheels seized up at some point just from wear and tear because it lasted longer than it was supposed to, and it dragged its wheel through a spot and dug up this fine-grained white powdery silica that was in the regolith, in the soil at the surface. And that was how they found it initially. And they were and they analyzed it and they thought, well, that looks different. Everything else is red and orange. And they found this white stuff and they looked at it and said, oh, that's silica. Where did that come from? And then it turned, I think they had some evidence from orbit that there was, silica deposits there, but they, didn't know what that meant. And then they discovered that this was, looked in more detail and found these hydrothermal type deposits, these morphological signatures of hydrothermal deposits. Yeah, so that's the kind of serendipity that can occur on these missions. So anywhere we go, we're going to find something new and learn something.
Let's talk to Jimmy in Norwood. Hi, Jimmy. Jimmy, go right ahead. Oh, lost Jimmy. We did have a question from Abraham in Dayton, and he was wondering why are we focusing on expeditions to Mars and not any of the other planets?
Well, I'm not involved in missions to any other planets, but there are missions in the works. There are plans to send a mission to, or at least, I can't remember the details of it. Again, I'm not involved with it, but I think there's a mission planned to go to Europa.
Yeah, that's going to be one of the next bigger ones. And I think that's got a lot of promise
and
to
Europa,
it as well.
Europa is, for those of us who don't know?
Europa is one of the moons of Jupiter.
Okay.
So it's about the size of our moon. And from our indications is that this is a place that has a liquid ocean of water underneath a lot of ice. And so, I'm a big fan of Europa and that Europa and the mission. The problem is that's four times farther away than Mars, so that involves a lot more difficulty. So I think there's a little bit of Mars is a little closer to us.
A little closer, yeah.
That makes it easier.
It's also Mars is a terrestrial planet. It's smaller than Earth, but it's, much more similar to Earth than the planets further out, the gas giants and their moons, though actually some of those moons are more similar to terrestrial planets, but Europa, of course, has an ocean covering it. So that's, I guess we have an ocean mostly covering our Earth too, but.
And then there's that, I was kind of struck by when you're describing what the rovers kind of found is we can find out so much from orbit, from these orbiters, and then we find out a little more by rovers. And I think, maybe, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but I think, Mars could be one of our future spots for humans to visit. I think that seems to be something, and that these rovers can learn so much, but there's advocates that say, okay, well, if we go with a human, they could find things a lot easier, maybe. Maybe. I don't know. It's one of those tough ones. But then again, you have to feed and keep a human alive all that way. And I don't know if we're ready for that. But these rovers are going to be they're doing amazing jobs because Curiosity's been there 5 years and Opportunity 13 years, I think, if my math is right. So it's amazing.
Okay. We've got Jimmy back. Oh, nope. He disappeared again. We keep losing Jimmy on the line. How are missions like this? Are they laying foundations for the possibility of sending people to Mars?
Yes. In fact, this mission, the Mars 2020 mission, has as part of its objectives to prepare for future human exploration. There's an instrument on the rover that will take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, because Mars's atmosphere is about 95% carbon dioxide. It's much, much thinner in terms of the pressure than Earth's atmosphere, but by percentage, it's mostly carbon dioxide. And the instrument is going to take that out and catalytically convert it into oxygen and test out that technology, which could then, if it works, be scaled up for humans to use, either as breathable oxygen or for a fuel. Also, there's instruments to analyze the atmospheric conditions and the radiation environment to understand. We've done that before too, or NASA's done that before, but it's always good to continue doing that, to learn about those conditions. And also some of the samples brought back, the plan is to collect a sample of what's called regolith, which is essentially Martian soil. It's not like soil on Earth. It's just basically broken up rock and sediment and sand and things like that at the surface. But we call it regolith, and collect a sample of that to study, again, when those samples are returned. Study the regolith in order to understand what's in it. What are humans going to be walking around on and kicking up and potentially breathing in if dust gets into the habitat? We don't know everything that's in that regolith. There could be toxic chemicals or toxic minerals and things like that. So that's what they want to study.
So it's safe to say that NASA wants to make sure everything is taken care of in terms of humans being safe when they go to Mars before we send humans to Mars.
Exactly.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
And as fans of The Martian would probably want to know, could you grow potatoes there? Right. as a geologist, now a Martian geologist, is that an accurate thing that was in the book? Could you grow potatoes on Mars?
Well, I'm really not sure. From what I understand, potatoes are easy to grow on Earth. They grow in just about any soil and any, anywhere. So, if you could grow anything, it probably would be potatoes.
Uh-huh. We'll find out at some point, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, we could bring back that regolith and, make up a big batch of stuff that's just like it and then try growing potatoes. Or corn or whatever we want.
Dean, wanted to ask you, too, today is the first day for your podcast, Looking Up.
That's right.
Congratulations
that's right.
on that,
well,
by
thank
the way.
You.
You and Anna Heeman are doing
yes,
great
together. Yes, yeah. So my coworker Anna and I, we started this podcast with WVXU here, and it's about astronomy, space, any popular topics that are coming across, because there's so many new discoveries being made in astronomy. So I play the part of the astronomer, and Anna plays the part of the non-astronomer to ask me the real tough questions, and the questions that kind of keep me down to earth a little bit. So it's a lot of fun that we get to. It's basically an outcropping from our conversations at the Cincinnati Observatory that drive our coworkers crazy. So she has so many great questions about these things. And we've had a lot of fun doing it so far.
What's the first episode going to be about?
The first episode that starts today is about exoplanets. So it's about planets orbiting other stars. And so we talked about Alpha Centauri a little bit, our closest star system to us that has a planet around it. We talked about TRAPPIST-1, the star that has 7 planets around it. I think we talk about Star Trek and Star Wars and get them confused also. So we apologize to any Star Wars fans and Star Trek fans. And then we also interviewed a student, Kevin Wagner, who helped discover a planet around another star. So it's a lot of fun.
Well, Dean, thank you. Andy, thank you very much. And Andrew, appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much.
UC Department of Geology Assistant Professor Dr. Andy Chaya, UC graduate student Andrew Gangadine, and Cincinnati Observatory Outreach Astronomer Dean Regas.